Hi, everybody. Today, we're speaking with Professor Xiaopeng Shen of Penn State University. He teaches and researches there as part of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. And the reason we're talking today has to do specifically with our recent news cycle, where we covered the historic flooding in Texas, and we're continuing to look forward to see a forecast that includes more flooding, perhaps more flash flood warnings and alerts. And as I told you, I thought to myself when this news was developing, well, what about innovation? What about artificial intelligence? We hear so much about AI. How can AI help perhaps in these sort of situations? So I just started to do a little research. And the very first article that came up is an article entitled "Improving Predictions of Flood Severity, Place and Time with AI." A novel framework offers accurate water flow predictions and simulations with unprecedented efficiency. This article was published on July 2nd, 48 hours before this July 4th flood, and this article is describing Professor Shen's research. So this is how we connected. I reached out to Professor Shen. We had a conversation. AI is a new topic for a lot of us. I wanted to make sure I wrapped my head around it. And Professor, it's so nice of you to take time to join us. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Very glad to be here.
I knew we were going to get along when you told me that you're from a very, very small town in China that only has 20 million people. And I thought, okay, we have a professor that talks about AI that has a sense of humor, so that's gonna work in our favor. So tell me just a little bit about your journey to this research. I'm gonna ask you specifically about your work when it comes to flooding, but how did you get even involved in this kind of whole area of research that you're a part of, and how did you wind up at Penn State University?
Right. So my journey actually started when I was the kid in that small town that you mentioned called Chengdu, where the town that I was born in, and that has 20 million people now. That there was a lot of water. It's very scenic. A lot of things around to explore. If your audience have not been there, I highly encourage, if you're in China, just go visit. There's a lot so thick culture and scenery. But there's also flooding hazards, but also environmental concerns. So that got me into environmental research, and I came to the United States in 2024 to do my PhD in environmental engineering at Michigan State University. So my PhD was working in one track, and I later become a system professor at Penn State University in 2012. In the middle of my tenure track work, I started to pay attention to this AI technology, because I was looking for something that can get us started new. In the field, there have been many, many theory-driven work. But at the time, I feel like there were so many limitations to those theories. I was looking for something that can start us anew. And AI really caught my attention, and that's around 2016 and 17. So it's been a few years now. You know, at the time, the AI was catching a lot of attention in terms of breaking records in image recognition. Nowadays, if you talk to people, AI was mostly about maybe ChatGPT or those bots that respond to you, the bots that generate videos. But there are very widespread of AI applications in science. It's like wildfires. It's taken off absolutely like bonkers, because we find it to be able to, the one key strength it has is to the ability to absorb information exhaustively from big data. And that's something we never had before.
And that's important about AI, isn't it? We're at a stage now, and we're going to all kind of be taught a lesson here about AI. I feel like we're just at the beginning of kind of, again, wrapping our heads around it. AI is about having the ability to take a lot of input, so a lot of data, and then be able to synthesize or look at that data in a way that a human brain cannot. Professor Shen, is that a good way of kind of understanding where AI is now?
The breadth, the capacity of AI is just absolutely beyond anything that human mind can approach. The volume of information it can store and the kind of the speed of computation. So, you know, you could understand AI like ChatGPT as learning from the totality of the things that we said, you know, the things we write on the internet, everything that we've written, it grasps, absorbs exhaustively from that, and gradually learn how humans think. It's really trying to mimic our brain. However, AI in science, In a way, we show it the data from the natural world, the collected data that showed how nature works, right? So basically, after showing it many, many times, it gets an idea of how nature works. So we find here, I would classify myself in water science, geosciences in general. We have a lot of sensing data that, you know, we have satellite, we have probes in the ground, we have many gauges in the rivers, and one of which is that provides the USGS gauging stations, provides very key instrumental data for us to know what's going on. And that data set are used to train AI algorithms that basically knows how the land system, the water system responds to storms, responds to snowmelt. So after training the AI, it basically has the ability to more accurately describe the nature's response to forcings.
I think that's one of the things that you said to me yesterday that really sat with me. And I'm going to summarize, and you could tell me if I have it correctly. You said AI is getting an idea of how human thinks, but the way that we can use it in science is getting an idea of how Mother Nature thinks and predicting how Mother Nature will behave, which is just a concept, just even thinking about that. It brings up all sorts of philosophical questions, which I also want to ask you, Professor Shen. But how does it apply here? So with the model, again, your research just recently came out. There was no way, by the way, or maybe there was, of predicting that we would see this sort of flood event that we saw here in Texas, and now the other flooding that we're seeing across the country. So tell us about your research, and how does it work? How does this model work?
There are two parts of the stories to this. First is about weather, right? How much rainfall you have. And that's the prime, that's a big driving force. That is, to us, is an input, right? So that's upstream of us. So what I do is to transform that signal into what is the flow rate in the rivers, how much water seeps into the ground, and how much of that groundwater comes out at a, you know, expected rate. So that's called hydrology. So we study the hydrologic dynamics and try to understand what kind of flood flow rate you would have in the rivers, right? So our models in the past used to describe these processes one by one. Our physical calculations, we come up with equations to describe all these soil moisture, groundwater, surface water, all these processes, right, one by one. But we found that there to be some major limitations. There are normally some knobs in the models. You can dial up and down. You think about these knobs as sort of the cranks, the things you crank out of on your bicycle or on your machinery. They can tune the behavior of the model. So we have a very hard time, you know, determining where to put those knobs in. And all of a sudden AI comes along. So the first generation of these AI models, they would directly, we show them the date, the how much rainfall there is, and what happened to the stream flow, you know, how much the flow rate in the rivers. And they automatically, inside the AI, they build a connection, a mapping relationship between that rainfall and the flood. And they turn, because they are very objective, they have no ego, right? They are very, abide by the data very, very much. So typically they can predict those responses fairly accurately, right? Actually, much more accurately than our previous traditional models. So that already was a major wave of advancement. However, that part of the work also has one major flaw, which is what happens to those events that it has never seen, right? Because you showed it many examples. It's like a kid. You showed this example. What if there's a new thing that it never happened in the past and that's not in the record? The AI sometimes does erratic things when that happens. And that's precisely when a dangerous flood could cause damages. So to us, if you have erratic behaviors or, you know, underestimation of those dangers, it's unacceptable to us, right? So recently, our work that you see on this article is actually combining the AI with equations. So essentially, we're reducing the roles of AI to a sidekick, to like a sous chef per se. So our calculations actually be the master chef that's driving the vehicle. So the sous chef would bring about important tools, important materials, and figure out some tough problems. But then our own calculations is driving the main thing. So by doing this hybrid kind of approach, We are able to leverage the learning capability of the AI, whereas we also have certain expected behavior that can guarantee success under these even unseen situations.
So that's really interesting. It's like building blocks. So I know we threw a lot of analogies. We got sous chefs. We got all sorts of things in here. But if you have a building blocks of existing forecasts and existing data that's out there, and then you're like, well, wait a minute, let's add AI into this. And we're going to need some of that data that we've been collecting and will continue to collect. But this is going to give us that little something extra that will hopefully help us predict what is coming. And in this case, it would be a flood. How accurate can you be?
So we have various metrics to measure our success. And so if we allow certain data ingestion at the national scale, we can get to a what we call 0.86. That means we can explain 86% of the variance. So you still have some outliers. You still have some cases where the model is not able to capture it precisely. That typically is because our upstream, that rainfall data, has some errors, or it's really something that it has not seen in the past. So there's still some errors, but generally we're like doing much better than before. Actually, we've been developing this model for 1.5 years. I think we've made more progress than what has happened previously along the previous trajectory in 7 years. So, and we are actually all the metrics show that we're much more accurate than before.
That's so interesting. And to also understand how quickly some of this technology is moving.
Yeah,
and
especially in other words, a part of the evolution is happening at minute scale with AI, right? So it picks up information and evolve at a minute scale. Whereas in the past, we have to perceive what's wrong and we propose a correction and we iterate doing experiments to find out whether it's true or not. So that experimentation, human in the loop, is quite long. Now you could let AI evolve and it's just happening on much, much faster speed.
Yeah, it's really, it seems like it's a very fascinating time to be alive in this period of technology.
Hope it stays under control. Another story.
I am going to ask you a question about that at the end of our conversation. Before we get to the Texas flood specifically, because I wanted to ask you about that, and I know there were some things that made that event particularly unusual, but how far in the future can your model see? You know, forecasting is always about that. You know, you get the night forecast for the next day and you kind of think it could be correct, but sometimes it's totally wrong. In this situation, how much of a heads up could a community get if they used your model and it was an area that has seen flooding in the past?
In terms of the computational speed, we're like trivial. It's like a minute is enough. But the predictability, I think the barrier is not on my end. It's rather on the weather forecast end. Because so like I explained, the weather forecast is a upstream information to us. And to your point, there are people who's working on AI-infused AI weather models, like either GraphCastNet from Google, you know, Pangu Weather from some groups in China. There's many, many groups who are working on refining the AI prediction, using AI to refine weather prediction, hopefully making it better. But there's a lot of research and rabbit hole to go down. I'm hopeful that part is going to improve. However, we are in terms of the weather forecast, we're basically limited by the weather forecast quality. And a week after, typically the success of weather prediction is much, much lower, right? The next few days is pretty good enough. So so basically you give me the weather forecast of the next few days, then I feed it into my hydrologic model so we can give you that forecast.
Let's use the Texas flood. And again, we know that the water in this case rose extremely, extremely fast. And the rain predictions were high, but not as high as what actually fell. And one of the things we learned from speaking to Ben Knoll, who's a meteorologist and global weather writer for the Washington Post, said, yes, we can get pretty good as far as knowing that it's going to rain or knowing that it's going to thunder, but we can't tell you when the first thunder strike is going to happen and where exactly it's going to take place. He's like, so there is some unpredictability in that. But do you see that your model could have been helpful in the Texas flood that we just saw?
I think we can reduce the errors and reduce the uncertainty in the hydrologic component, in the land component of this whole story, right? But the forcing component, this model doesn't really solve that problem. And somebody else, many other groups are working on that problem. I heard, you know, the... Yeah.
Can I stop you there? Let's just say that the weather forecaster in this situation in Texas said, okay, it's 10 to 15 inches of rain. Could you run that model, but then could you also give it a worst case scenario and say, okay, they're saying 10 to 15 inches, but let's just run it to see if there's 30, and then have both of those situations in front of you?
That's actually a very good idea. So we actually do that. So that's called probabilistic forecast. So we will run different scenarios of rainfall, and you know, we will, and also different scenarios of initial conditions, like how wet the soil already is, and that has some impact on the outcomes as well. So we will run all these different scenarios, mix them together. We give you like an envelope of that prediction. We tell you, you know, that in the very unfortunate case, this would be how high it would be, or on the lowest, the safest case, how low it would be. We can give you an envelope in that. And I do think that our tool can greatly reduce that uncertainty in the whole workflow. But there'll still be uncertainty with respect to the weather forecasting, because that's a hard job. And with respect to this event, I think it's a very hard case. From what I've known, it's a mesoscale. It's not that big of a scale, and it's very intense, very rapid. I think, you know, if we were to deploy our model, I guess if the weather data is really wrong, then there's not much we can do about it. But if the weather data is good, and I think we can describe, I can at least provide some very relevant warnings. Hopefully.
So, so in application, so let's say there's the National Weather Service says, okay, we're going to see a really big rain event in this particular area, and they send out a flood alert, or they're really alerted to flood around midnight. In this situation, it was around 1 a.m., but even before that, would you then, with that information, be able to spit out to whoever's in charge or whoever's looking at this data, listen, there's a 5% chance here that we could see a really bad flash flood in the next, you know, 6 hours. Is that how it could be applied?
Yes, exactly. So there's actually operational models even now at this point. You know, it's a subsidiary of the National Weather Service. It's called Weather Forecasting Offices. They are responsible for running these hydrologic models even right now as we speak, or even before this event. They're running these models to get what the flow rate is at different critical cross sections in the river network. Our models will allow us to do is to make a seamless prediction everywhere in the nation, really, maybe a day ahead of time or 6 hours ahead of time. And based on the flow rates, we can issue warning. It's possibly issue warnings. Of course, I want to say that our model is a candidate model now, and it normally takes some time for the administration to understand and absorb it and make their choices. But I think we can improve some of the accuracy in that regard. But the other aspect that we enable is that their model is very efficient. Also, it allows you to, like you said, it allows us to run many, many different scenarios. It's like looking into the future, you know, what are the possible branches that could happen? We can run many of those at a much faster speed. So that allows you to, you know, better quantify the possibilities.
It's my understanding that your team is running a model now based on the Texas flood. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking at there?
Yeah, so we have been looking at getting the near real-time forcing data, the weather forecast, and you know, organize it in the way that we want, and then we pass it through our hydrological model, and we're planning to look at the river stages all across Texas, and we want to quantify the spatial extent of the flood. We understand the anticipating conditions before the event, and understand why is it that it arose so fast, right? Even though at the site, maybe at that location, it doesn't seem like it's raining that hard as you would expect such a large flood, right? So there's a lot of transported water from upstream, right? From whatever, there's a heavy storm in the upstream and the water is transported downstream. That's why it seems so surprising to people, like, you right. know, I mean, yeah.
Well, in this particular case, I'm glad you reminded us of that, because just a few miles away, there were folks that thought, oh, it's not even raining really. You know, what are we getting these flood? It's raining a little bit. Oh, there's a thunderstorm that's come through, but it's not dumping rain, or it's not really getting, everyone was having a little bit of a different experience all along this river. Do you see a scenario, Professor Shen, where like on my phone, as I'm getting a flood warning or I'm getting a weather forecast, that your model would also pass along to direct to consumers through, you know, our weather service or National Weather Service, that sort of probability? Like, hey, Jenna, where you are in your area, there's a 20% chance of actual flood. And so people can start making their own decisions. We know even in the news, when there's an evacuation alert, that there's some people that are not going to evacuate, because they don't necessarily believe the weather predictions. But if maybe there was a little bit more data where someone says, okay, this is going to be a 10% chance or a 20% chance of a major flood event, you know, I wonder what people do with more information. I don't know.
I don't know about that, but we can indeed provide more information, more education. I don't know about Texas. Actually, where I am in Pennsylvania, I do get these messages, like it says flood warning, pay attention to a certain street, there could be a flood. I do get that. I'm not sure, you
know,
if it's
different,
works differently.
Well, we get it too. The people got it along the river as well, but because they got it so often and it never flooded, they didn't really take it that seriously. And that's where the issue is. So if you see, you know, if you see a flood alert and it's a 50% chance of a flash flood, and I run a summer camp, I might look at that differently than a flood alert that I got last week where the river, you know, rose a foot or two and had like a little bank flooding. So that's what I'm curious about. I don't know, as a journalist, you know, sometimes providing more information or more content isn't the key. It's being able to explain it in a way that leads to action or leads someone to be able to make up their own mind. And a free press is about, but I wonder about here too.
I do think that that's a very critical point. Like, you know, when we shoot out these warnings, obviously you want to be as accurate as possible, so every time when you get a warning, it's really likely that something's going to happen, then you respect it much more, right? I do think that the ability of our tools, and not only ours but other people's tools, that are able to reduce that uncertainty will actually facilitate this, making the accuracy higher. And some people there's some groups who's doing this in India and other countries. And I think in the US, people are trying to do that. But there's still a lot of room for us to improve the accuracy, to reduce that false positive, that false negative, right? So either can be bad, right? The false positive, like you think, makes people habituate people to not paying attention. Right. So I think there's room to improve all of that.
We know the Texas state government's having a special legislative session. They're going to be reviewing what happened with this flood. Is your technology available? So if a state wanted to apply it just for their state, could they start using your AI addition to the forecasting?
So I think that we are going to go in from multiple paths. One is through the National Weather Service or National Flood Forecasting Service. There's a rigorous evaluation criteria, which may be sometimes a little long in terms of evaluating these models and how what they include in their main chain. There's also a formal peer review process. There's many things that need to happen. So I very respect that. But there are also river forecasting centers who are actually kind of happy to take up this technology. And we have spoken to some of them, and they're happy to take the technology. I think we can go both ways. And we're, for example, working with the Mid-Atlantic River Forecasting Centers to update them on our progress. And I think they're certainly happy to take and read our technology. But of course, I think what you mentioned is on a different front, maybe on on the legal scale, you know, maybe we're in a mentally in a much prepared position to make those decisions right now. But I think the Congress or, you know, your state government, they still need to rely on expertise. They need to rely on experts to make those decisions, right? So they'll come back to actually the forecasting offices.
You talk about this process too of approval mm-hmm. and integration, and that's something right. that AI has not sped up in government, to my knowledge. It's still a very long process. And we respect it, and we appreciate the due diligence that has to take place still on a human level, but it's a long process. Final question for you, or maybe final thoughts on this. I was just listening to an interview the other day that was talking about how AI will lead to someone making me dinner at my house or getting it delivered in an Amazon-like fashion. So everyone would have their own personal chef sometime over the next like 10 years, 10 to 15 years. So as a mom who's not a particularly good cook, this is something that I thought, wow, that would be an amazing, perhaps life-changing way to use AI. what do you see? I mean, you're in this field of research. What do you think are the ways that AI is going to really significantly change everyday life for people?
So I think it's going to take shorter than 15 years for what you've said to happen.
Really?
Because things are just accelerating. You hear that's a point of singularity, you know, things are just taking off and they're going faster and faster. So I work a lot in AI and science, and there's a lot of AI that can be used to advance our science. So our science is now accelerating as well, and actually science feedback to the main AI. So we publish papers on the AI conferences as well. So we actually feedback because we bring our unique perspectives. In the end, this whole thing is like really taking off like an exponential speed. So I personally don't think it's going to take 15 years for that to happen. it'll be faster. Yeah, and the productivity level is going to be faster as well.
It's wild to think about. Do you ever get somewhat conflicted of how far science is and AI is pushing into this realm of it feels otherworldly? You know, that when we think about Mother Nature, are we thinking about a bigger force? We're thinking about God. I think those questions come up with AI as well. When we start hearing that these machines or this machine learning is doing things that we cannot do naturally, but yet we would love to tell the future a little bit if we could save someone's life, especially when it comes to flood. So I feel like there's a tension there between those two things, and I'm wondering how you navigate it as a researcher, right, but also as a person.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, there's these AI specific companies, and like I said, what they're trying to do is to mimic what people do. Like they can actually replicate what people do, and they will cook dinner for you at some point. I think there are other applications where the AI can do what people cannot do. They can understand nature, they can understand physics, they can understand chemistry. I think those are very beneficial, and they will help us advance our science faster and advance our understanding. However, I think we need to actually think carefully about, you know, replacing people's value, because there's some serious consequences, and some people will be hurt badly. I feel like quite bad about that. But these two are different realms. So I work in the second, fortunately for me, so it's easy for me to say that. But there's all the resources and lots of money are in the first, and everybody's rushing, like you say. You know, you like U.S., even Europe, even China, nobody wants to be left behind. So this is indeed somewhat troubling to me.
It's an interesting thing to start thinking about, of just how the world will look different for our children, and how that will be so great in so many ways, especially if you don't necessarily want to cook dinner, but maybe in other ways more dangerous. Go ahead.
I want to add one comment. So our human society also have a trouble handling these low probability, but long-term low probability event like flood. And like I explained to you yesterday, our mindset works like a pendulum. When something bad like this flood happens, we're very nervous. We want to make legislation, hopefully something positive that we can come up with it. But then after some years, we gradually get relaxed and we don't pay attention, you know, until the next event hits. So I think we need to rethink carefully about these long-term low probability disasters and how we manage them. And if we need to build in floodplain, what should we, how how should you be ready? Because when you're on a flat plane, you're almost guaranteed that something's going to happen in a number of years. And, you know, as these extreme events become more frequent, it's actually happening more frequent. Low probability event will happen. So we have to rethink about how we manage our infrastructure.
Yeah, it's such a good point, because if you say to someone, well, it's a 100-year floodplain, or it's a 1 in 1,000-year event, that tells me one story. But if I said the probability of this event is actually very high given these certain variables happening, then I start adjusting myself perhaps differently. So it's a good point of how we're sort of telling the story to ourselves and how urgently we see to address it depending on what happened. And in this case, very devastating. Professor Shen, will you please keep us posted on your work? We'd love to hear more of how it's going and hope
Absolutely.
For better weather forecasting and rain forecasting in the future. So the input is really good. But it's exciting to hear about your work, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. If I get some results, I'll keep you updated. And very happy to be here. Thank you for reaching out.
Attention all small biz owners. At the UPS Store, you can count on us to handle your packages with care. With our certified packing experts, your packages are properly packed and protected. And with our pack and ship guarantee, when we pack it and ship it, we guarantee it. Because your items arrive safe or you'll be reimbursed. Visit the upsstore.com/guarantee for full details. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Come into your local store today.